Thanks for joining us and welcome to the Stonebridge Church Podcast. Here at Stonebridge, our goal is to lead people into a real, healthy, and growing relationship with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to join us live, we hold services every Sunday at 9:30 and 11:05 a.m. at 1 Stonebridge Church Drive in the Woodlands, Texas. You can also stream our services online on Facebook, our website, our YouTube channel, and our church app. We invite you to check out our website at GoStonebridge.com and give us a like on Facebook at Facebook.com/GoStonebridge. This week, teaching pastor Josh Bramlett wraps up our series, Daniel. New city, same hope. Now, here's Pastor Josh.
All right, well, happy Palm Sunday. Hey, next week is Easter. Do people realize that? That's pretty great. I feel like this spring, winter time just kind of flew by, and we're already at Easter. It's also April Fool's Day, so if you show up and no one's here, joke's on you. You can just go home. I'm just kidding. We're going to be here, so just come. And as Brian was just praying, Easter is such an excellent opportunity to invite somebody. People who are not thinking about church, don't go to church on Easter, they're thinking about church. And so it's a unique opportunity for you to think through your people of influence at work, your neighborhood, and all these different kind of places to just reach out and say, hey, I've got a service I'd love for you to come with, and let's go together. And Easter's an awesome time for that. So use that, please. So if you haven't been here the last 6 or 7 weeks, I think, we've been kind of rolling through the book of Daniel. And so I want to talk about Daniel briefly, because I think Daniel, as we look forward, as we talk about Palm Sunday and as we talk about Good Friday and Easter, there's something in Daniel that I think helps us, as we look at it, helps us look forward into the New Testament, into those kind of moments. And so if we could, let's take a look at Daniel's life for a second. Let's step back and just look at the sort of the 30,000-foot version. So Daniel is exiled from Jerusalem. The Babylonians take over Jerusalem and exile the people. And so Daniel is around 15 when this moment took place, right? And so I can imagine that moment was extremely difficult for Daniel and the people of Israel. Obviously, they've just been conquered, and now they're being shipped off to a strange land, a land that's not theirs. And they are essentially they're kind of prizes of war. They're exiles. So I can imagine that was difficult. Daniel, being a Jewish boy, would have known the history of their people. He would have known the promises of their people. He would have known the stories of God's deliverance, of God's perseverance of their people, of him establishing them, choosing them as his own people. And so I'd imagine that his understanding of what was happening, what God was doing, was just massively wrecked in this moment. Even as the people are being exiled to Babylon, the prophet Jeremiah, in the book of Jeremiah, writes, as they're being exiled, a new promise that God makes to them, that God would one day restore them, that God would one day allow them to return. And as we keep reading through the Old Testament, we see through the book of Nehemiah that takes place. But God gives them new promises and new ideas. And so I'm not sure if Daniel knew about that promise, but Daniel definitely knew about the promises in the past. And then if you're reading through Daniel, I don't know if you've noticed a turn. So in Daniel chapter 6, which Steve preached about last week, Daniel is 85 years old when the Den of Lions story takes place. And when we think about that story, normally we picture kind of a young Daniel. Daniel is an old guy when that moment happens. And then, as we go chapter 7 of Daniel, stuff sort of takes a turn, right? If you're reading Daniel 6 and you start reading Daniel 7, and all of a sudden you're like, okay, I'm not following anything that's happening here. That's okay, right? That's okay. I went to seminary. Sometimes I don't either. Daniel is receiving these prophecies from God. And so there are even more promises. God's giving Daniel even more promises about the future. But again, let's step back and let's look at Daniel's life. Daniel goes into exile at 15. And he waits, and he waits, and he waits, knowing God's promises. He sees kings change. He sees the regimes that are in charge change. He sees the nation that overtook his nation is overtaken by other nations. And all the while, he must be wondering, okay, is this the time? Is this where God remembers his promises to us? So as we look at Daniel's life is a waiting life. His story is a part of a much larger story, and in his life, he is waiting. And as I thought about the Christian life, look, you and I are situated in a unique time where if you're a Christ follower, the Christian life is a waiting life. we find ourselves between two promises. We have the promise of the birth of Jesus, which we celebrate at Christmas time. And then we're sort of stuck in this position of waiting for Christ to return one day. And so the Christian life is a waiting life. And culturally, I feel like this is harder for us. Not that waiting wasn't always hard, but for us, it's unique because we live in an age in which technology has advanced in such spectacular ways that we don't have to wait for a lot of things anymore, right? You want a frozen meat pocket that you can stick in the microwave and eat? You can do that now. It's called a hot pocket. I don't know why you would, but if you want to, you can. They make instant coffee, right? Instead of like having to like grind the beans yourself, they actually make machines that grind it for you, and then machines that will make it for you and even make it at any hour, and you can have it for you when you wake up. That's what I do every single morning. We have news and information at our fingertips at all times. You can answer any question that you have in your mind right now. You could answer right now. So we live in a unique time. And so this has made us waiting for us has become harder. It has, right? And it starts with things that we can see and we can touch. It starts with things that we see happen faster, and then it inevitably moves to intangible things, things that we can't see or touch, things that are tied to our emotions, that are tied to the spiritual. So our success or our happiness or our desires, it becomes harder and harder for us to wait for those things to come to fruition. Or even in our pain, difficult things, our children's successes, our children's happiness, our children's pain, our children's difficulties, we want those things. We hate waiting on those things, and we hate waiting for those things to take place or to go away. We struggle with waiting. Now, waiting isn't our sort of age's struggle. The difficulty in waiting is profoundly human. It's profoundly human. No human on earth ever was just okay with waiting at any time. So Tom Petty was right that waiting in life is the hardest part. If Steve were here, he would have sung that line, but I'm not Steve, so I'm not going to. I'm not going to do that. But it's true. In the Christian life, it's full of waiting. And as we think about Easter and as we think about going forward, waiting is hard. And the Bible speaks to that difficulty. The Bible speaks to that difficulty and also gives it meaning, which I hope we find encouraging today. So I'm going to read a story that really just, I think, fully encapsulates the feeling and pain and yet purpose of waiting. And so if you have your Bibles, go to Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5, verse 21 says that when Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him. And so he stayed by the seashore. And one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up and seeing him fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live." And he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. And a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of many physicians and had spent all that she had and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse. And after hearing about Jesus, she came up in the crowd behind him and touched his cloak, for she thought, "If I just touched his garments, I will get well." And immediately the flow of blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. And immediately Jesus, perceiving in himself that power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And the disciples said, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see the woman who had done this, but the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." So this story opens with a guy named Jairus, who's a synagogue official. And so picture in your mind someone of the likes of the Pharisees. He comes to Jesus and is begging Jesus for his help. Now, outside of Jesus, this entire narrative that we just read and the narrative that's to follow is centered on Jairus. So let's take a minute. I think it's going to be helpful for us to try to, as much as we can, situate ourselves in his shoes to feel what he felt so we can understand kind of what's taking place here. So Jairus comes to Jesus, and he calls Jesus. He says, my daughter is to the point of death. Now, it's easy to kind of read over that and not really think about the implications of that, but picture this scenario. Jairus' daughter is dying. He had tried everything that he could think of. He had done everything that he could, and yet he is sitting there watching his little daughter waste away in front of him. As a parent, like I can just envision myself, like I will do whatever it takes. As parents, when our kids are in that situation, like we would literally, if necessary, would rip our own selves apart and give the parts necessary to fix this problem. We would drain all of ourselves to switch spots with our child at this moment. That is the sense of desperation that Jairus feels when he throws himself at the feet of Jesus and says, Jesus, you're the only thing that can fix this. So this is the state of Jairus. For what we know about him, he's a good and godly man, but he is desperate. He has done all that he can. He's heard about Jesus, presumably. He knows that Jesus is working miracles, and so this is it. This is it. His daughter is literally on the verge of death. She could die at any moment. This is the mindset of Jairus as he meets with Jesus. And so step one, Jairus completes his sort of first task to get Jesus to agree. Jesus agrees. Step two seems like a harder task. They now have to go from this point to Jairus' house. I don't know how far that was, but you can sense that Jairus has this anxiety about him, and there is a crowd here, and moving is going to be very difficult and very slow. There are literally crowds pressed in on him, and there's no bodyguards that Jesus had. Jesus, you know, doesn't have a limo that he can kind of duck into and escape the crowd that's following him. He is pressed about. People are everywhere calling him out, asking him questions, asking to be healed, asking, you know, him just things about his life or the way he sees things. So there are crowds, massive crowds. And so I can imagine that in this moment, Jairus feels the clock ticking. He feels the clock ticking. He knows that every moment wasted here could literally cause his daughter to die. That if this delay goes any further, the worst thing in his mind could come to fruition. The worst thing, the worst possible scenario, if Jesus doesn't hurry. And then something inexplicable happens. I can imagine Jairus just kind of like tugging Jesus along, like, okay, let's go. Jesus stops, and he's like, who touched me? And even the disciples make out a point to say, what do you mean who touched you? You're in a crowd of people. Everyone's touching you, right? And so Jesus not only stops, but he begins to talk to this woman and heals her and has a conversation with her. And look, a thousand sermons, literally a thousand is probably too small, probably hundreds of thousands of sermons have been preached about this woman, and rightfully so. But here's what I don't want us to miss. This moment in time with this woman is not accidental. It's not incidental. It's not. It is directly tied to the story of Jairus. This story of this woman is a story about the waiting of Jairus. That Jesus doesn't stop by happenstance. It's not like he forgot what he was doing. It's not like he forgot the feeling of rush that there's someone in need, that Jairus is sitting here. He needs me to hurry. Jesus doesn't forget that. But he stops and he engages with this woman and has a conversation with her. And this is the story about Jairus's waiting. And so if you're a note taker, here's kind of the first point that I think we draw out of this and sort of see in ourselves. That God uses our waiting to move us to a different place of dependency and intimacy. I can imagine during this whole ordeal that Jairus is not leaving the side of Jesus. He's not going anywhere without Jesus. He's not going to run ahead and tell his friends, okay, well, Jesus is coming. He understands that the clock is ticking and I've got to stay by Jesus. I can imagine he is out front. He's probably throwing bows at people to get out of the way, that this guy needs to get to my house. There is a sense of that Jairus is not leaving Jesus' side. We are going to get from point A to point B as fast as I can, and I am not leaving you until we do so. But he is pulling Jesus. It's this picture of dependency. It's this picture of intimacy, that he is dependent on Jesus, that he needs to be close to him. He needs to get him from point A to point B. When I think about dependency, kids are a beautiful picture. Children reveal to us the beauty of waiting. They do. So in my house right now, there are certain boxes of independency that I would love to get checked off, right? I got little kids. So first, like, big box that I am waiting for independent things to start happening is, like, let's just get out of diapers, okay? Like, I've got three kids in diapers. I'm desperately waiting for that box of independence to be checked off, right? If you want to love me with diapers. Right? That's how I feel love. I'm desperately waiting for that moment to take place. The next box I would love to get checked is, like, let's go to the bathroom on our own, right? Let's do that. If we do that, we'll be in better shape. Next box is, okay, let's get dressed by ourselves. If we can do that, we'll be in good shape. Final box is, like, let me just sleep alone. Like, let me, you, while y'all are awake, let me sleep. Like, if we can get to that point, life will be good, right? And so those are boxes of independence that we would love to check as parents. But then there are other times, there are other boxes that we want our kids to wait on, that we do not want to see happen quickly. I think about the first time that I'm going to have to drop my oldest daughter off at school on her own. I'm going to be bawling like a baby, right? That's going to be a very difficult moment for me, because it is this relinquishing of dependence that I'm having to give this away. And I wish that, you know, that we could wait a little bit on that. There are times as parents where we wish we could pump the brakes on our kids as they move and as they grow. Maybe for you, it's like, that's not a big deal, Josh. That's crazy that you think that's a big deal. There are much more significant boxes coming. Just wait, right? And so maybe that for you, it's a car, right? Maybe that you're worried about that. You're like, no, I've been driving my kid around for 15 years. I'm not worried about that. That's awesome. But cars communicate something else. Something else is coming. And so maybe it's that moment where you've packed your kid up and you've driven them off to a different place and you've come home and your house is empty. Some of you are like, no, that was a great moment. But others might, that was a difficult moment to relinquish. And that you wish that, man, I could, can we have slowed that down a little bit? Can we have waited just a little bit longer on that, right? Maybe it's the ultimate thing where, like, you're walking your daughter down the aisle and you've got to give her away to somebody else. The ultimate exchange of dependency there. It's a hard moment. And so what this communicates to us, that there are times in our lives where we just want to, we want our kids to wait. Just wait a little while longer, because in those moments, I still feel needed. I still feel like you are dependent on me. And we love that feeling as parents. My mom to this day literally still calls me, sometimes crying, because she feels like I don't need her anymore. Real story. It happens all the time. She's like, you don't need me anymore. I'm like, Mom, I'm a grown man. Like, I still need you. I just don't need you to change my clothes, right? I don't need you to, like, wash my clothes. I can do that now, right? And so, but we have these deep-seated feelings of dependency that we there are some instances in which we like to give dependence, but there are some things that hurt us to the core when we give up that dependence and we wish that we could wait a little longer. For you and I, when it comes to God, like, we never come to a place of full independence. We don't ever get to that spot, and we're not ever supposed to. We're never supposed to. And so, in fact, we see that God actually takes our waiting, and he actually uses it to foster not more independence, but more dependence. That God actually values our dependency. We need to be dependent on God. And so God takes our waiting and he uses it to actually make us more dependent on him and draw us close. And when we phrase it in that way, it, like, waiting, although harder, does make sense. It makes sense that God makes us wait, not because he doesn't love us, not because he wants us to walk through difficult things, but it's because he wants to draw us close to him. He wants us near to him. He wants us to need him. He wants us to understand that we need him, because we do. We don't live in a world, if we are at a place where we think that we don't need God for things, you are at the worst place you could possibly be. And so sometimes God will take our difficult situations, our waiting, things that we have longed to achieve, things that we have longed to come to fruition, things that we have longed to just end. Can this be over yet? God takes those things and he actually fosters us in close. C.S. Lewis once said that pain is God's megaphone. That pain is God's megaphone. And I always thought that was interesting when I read that. But it's the idea that we hear God the loudest and the clearest when we've gone through pain, when we are experiencing pain. It's the idea that when life is good and when things are going well, we struggle to recognize God in those situations. We typically struggle to recognize that God is the reason that those things are happening. And so sometimes God's voice gets very sort of put back in the distance, put in the back of our minds, and it's not at the forefront. But when we experience pain, it causes us to draw near to God and say, what gives? It's when God's voice is the loudest and the clearest. I would say that waiting is God's whisper. That when we are waiting, we are forced to sort of draw in close to God, to hear his voice at a whisper, to become at this intimate moment. It's like the sound of a father reading a book to his child. It's intimate, it's quiet, it requires closeness. It's this picture of dependency. So Jesus knew the feelings that were happening in Jairus. He knew. He knew the sense of anxiety that was building in Jairus, that this moment, this interruption was causing him this massive amounts of stress it's like all of a sudden Jairus thought that, well, Jesus doesn't know what I'm dealing with. He doesn't know what I'm going through. Jesus knew. He knew what the stakes were. But Jairus finds himself close to Jesus. Jairus finds himself completely dependent on Jesus in this moment. The story continues. It says, and while he was speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore? But Jesus, overhearing what was spoken, said to Jairus, do not be afraid any longer, only believe. And he allowed no one to accompany him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And they came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion, that people loudly weeping and wailing. And he entered in, and he said to them, why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep. And they began laughing at him. But putting him out, he took the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was. And taking the child by the hand, he said to her, Talitha cum, which translated means, little girl, I say to you, get up. And immediately the girl got up and began to walk, for she was 12 years old. And immediately they were completely astounded. So in the middle of Jairus waiting, he's waiting for Jesus to start moving again. In the middle of that, friends from Jairus' house come running and they say, look, man, sorry, she didn't make it. You waited too long. We weren't able to keep her alive. And Jesus, hearing this conversation, enters in and he makes a point to say that he is speaking directly to Jairus when he communicates this next sentence, which is important because I can imagine that there were thousands of people still around Jesus, but we get this sentence, and this sentence is directly to Jairus, and there's this sense that literally there is no one else there. That's how it feels. It feels like there is no one else there but him and Jairus. It's this picture of intimacy, and he looks at Jairus and he says, do you believe? Do you believe that I am bigger than what you are most afraid of? Do you believe that I have power over this situation? He tells Jairus, he says, don't be afraid. Keep believing. You see, waiting is tied to our fears. That behind our waiting are our fears that we have, fears about the future, fears about what might happen, and the waiting just kind of covers that. And in our waiting is this fear. And the Bible communicates that. The Bible communicates that Jesus knows. Jesus knows what Jairus is so afraid of. He understands and he knows, and he's asking us, he's saying, do you believe that I know what you're afraid of? Do you believe that I'm bigger than what you so desperately fear in your waiting? And just to drive home the point that the two stories we just heard aren't disconnected in any way, Mark lovingly and awesomely points out that this little girl was 12 years old. Now, as he went back and described the woman who was healed, this woman was bleeding, right? And I don't have time to go into all those details. Again, there's probably thousands of sermons on it. But the details are in a very short summary are this. She was bleeding, therefore she was considered unclean religiously. She was religiously unclean, meaning she could not participate in temple, which literally the entire society revolved around. So she was essentially a spiritual and social outcast, and she had tried everything. She had gone to doctors, she had gone to, you know, whoever to try to fix this problem, and it had only gotten worse. She was essentially spiritually dead. So Mark makes it a point to say this has been happening for 12 years. This woman was alive that had been dealing with this for 12 years. This girl who was 12 years old was dead, and on the same day, meet Jesus and are made alive. This story was for Jairus. It was for him to see that his waiting mattered. And here's the second point that as we think about, here's what we want to walk away with. Waiting is uncompromisingly linked to faith. That in our waiting, is meant to wrestle in and struggle with, okay, what does this mean? How does this shape my faith? Look, and we work this out practically all the time, that the balance of waiting and faith or waiting in belief. We work it out all the time. So we wait for things because we believe that they are worth it a lot. Growing up in Atlanta, I lived really close to Six Flags Over Georgia. And so me and my friends, whenever the newest ride would come out, we would go and we wanted to be one of the first people to ride it. Now, inevitably, we were not one of the first people to ride it because we stand in line for 4 hours to ride this ride, right? So essentially, theme parks are waiting parks, right? We like to think that they're not. Theme parks are parks that we go to wait in because we go and we stand in line for hours, and the percentage of time that we're actually on a ride is just unbelievably small compared to the time that we wait. But we do it. If you want good barbecue, like, you have to go well before lunchtime, and you are still probably going to stand in a line. But here's the truth. Smoked meat's worth it, right? So we believe that it's worth it, and so the waiting is okay. Black Friday, I used to work in a mall in my young college years. Like, Black Friday was the worst day of my life, right? The worst day, right? And because it's less now, we have Amazon, so we don't do Black Friday as much. But still, Black Friday, like, we'll go and we'll wait. We'll lose sleep. We'll punch someone who's trying to take the same plasma TV screen that I am, right? We do those things because we believe the payoff is worth it. We'll wait because we believe the payoff is worth it. And look, God works the same way. God desires our faith. He desires our belief. He desires our trust. And so he makes us wait. And again, it's not because he's mean. It's not because he wants us to experience pain. It's not because he wants to hurt us. But it's because he wants us to see that it is God himself who is the payoff. That if God solves all of our problems and gives us solutions to everything that we are waiting on, brings our waiting to an end, but and yet we don't have him, we still have nothing. Our problems have not been solved. And so sometimes God makes us wait to increase our faith in him in the hopes that he sees him as the prize. Because when we get to that point, then whatever we've been waiting for, even if it never happens, even if the thing that we have so desperately been praying to end, the thing that we wish was over, or the thing that we wish would just happen, even if that thing never happened, if we understood that God was the prize, and through waiting, we drew close to him, we gained intimacy, we gained dependence, our faith grew. If those things took place, then we'd gotten everything. Everything. God uses our waiting to show us through faith that it is he who is the ultimate prize. Look, and this is difficult to come to grips with, right? And the church sometimes doesn't do a good job of this. Sometimes when people are walking through really difficult waiting situations, we can gravitate to very trite and cliche sayings about, well, if you're in pain, you just got to have more faith, right? Or we'll pray for you, right? Those kind of things. And those things don't usually feel good. And look, that's not the way the Bible describes waiting. It's not the way it describes it. The Bible describes waiting and understands that waiting sometimes has very high stakes attached to it. So in your situation, the thing that you've been waiting for, there could be very high stakes attached to. That those stakes fill you with anxiety and anxiousness about the future or what is to come or what is not to come. The Bible understands that. The Bible phrases it in that way. Jairus loses his daughter. She dies. But the Bible also frames its encouragement with these things in mind, that it's God who through those moments, who through that waiting, who through that difficulty, God is the only one who can bring purpose. God is the only one who can bring you to a place of healing, that God is the only thing that's actually worth living for. He desires our trust, that through our waiting, we draw close to him, that our belief in him is strengthened, that we come to a different understanding of who he is while we wait. God does these things intentionally. And so let me take a second and just kind of speak, if I could, directly into situations that I know are difficult, that God knows is difficult. Maybe you're here and you are single, and the world has communicated to you that being single is not the way to be, that your ultimate fulfillment is going to be found once you get married. First of all, that's not true, not biblically, not now. But let me encourage you. If that's something that your heart has desired, but it just hasn't seemed to work out for some reason, look, God is in the waiting with you. God is moving in your waiting. Or maybe you're divorced, and you've come to this place where you're alone, and it was never your intention to be alone. You don't know how it came to this point, and you wish that this was over. Look, God is moving in your waiting. He knows. He understands. His desire is for you to draw close to him. Maybe you're married to an unbelieving spouse or even an unfaithful spouse, and you've been waiting and hoping and praying for belief to take shape, or you've been waiting and hoping and praying for restoration and reconciliation to happen, and you've been waiting, and your life has been filled with heartache, and you wish that it would be over or resolved. Look, God is moving in your waiting. He's with you. Maybe you are unable to have children, and that's been something that your heart has desired for so long. And as you look around, you just receive more reminders that you can't do that. God is in your waiting with you, and he is moving. All right, or you're sick, or you've got an illness that you've been waiting to get rid of. God is moving in your waiting. Look, life is just hard. Maybe it's not one thing. Maybe it's a series of things. Maybe you're just waiting for life to get a little bit easier. That all these things, you feel like life is just really, really stressful, and financially, you're just waiting for it to be better. You're waiting to be at a better spot. God is in you. God is with you in your waiting. And his desire is for us to draw close to him. Look, no delusion. Life is hard. Life is hard. Waiting is hard. We see this in Jairus. But we also see a trust in Jairus take shape, this belief that his waiting meant something, that God was doing something, and that God was lovingly increasing Jairus' dependence on him. That when we are waiting, God is moving. David phrases it this way in Psalms 40, 1 through 3. He says that I waited patiently for the Lord. I love this sentence. It says, and he inclined to me and heard my cry. It's this picture that like David is waiting on the Lord, and God hears David, and literally he inclines to him. It's just a picture again of drawing close. And he drew me up from the pit of destruction and out of the miry bog and set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. And he put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. And many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. That last sentence is incredibly significant too. And so David uses these poetic pictures of being stuck in a bog and stuck in a pit, places that if you are alone, you're not getting out of, right? This is the picture that David paints as he is waiting for the Lord. Terrible places to be in. David's waiting, but it says that David cried out to God and God drew close to him and drew him out of those places. And it says, put a new song in his mouth. The thoughts and words that are in our hearts when we are longingly waiting for something to occur are usually negative. They obsess our thoughts and our words. They obsess everything about it's the only thing that we can think about. And it's just this literally this cloud of negative. And it says, but David says that God rescued me. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise. It's this idea that God reshaped all of that through David's waiting, reshaped all of that. And I love that last sentence. And many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. Meaning that our waiting has purpose not just for us, but it also has purpose to those around us. That in our waiting, it's possible that some would see us in our waiting and begin to fear and trust the Lord. And so here's your last kind of point I want you to write down. God uses waiting to move us to a better place. As humans, we struggle to see the bigger picture. We just do. It's part of being human. We get blinders on and we become very focused and problem solving and become oriented that way. But the problem with that is that we lack perspective sometimes, and when problems begin to, we fixate on them and we wonder how to fix them. And so we just wait and wait for them to be fixed. But a lot of times God's timing doesn't work that way. And here's what's true. If you impose your understanding of timing onto God, you will struggle to feel loved by him. If you impose your timeline onto God, when God makes you wait, you will wonder why God has stopped loving you. And the scriptures communicate to us that that's not the case. That in fact, God makes us wait, allows things to not happen or happen because he loves us. Because he wants to draw us close. Because he wants to have an intimate relationship with us. Jesus deeply cared about timing. We see it in the story of Lazarus. So Lazarus dies. Jesus actually waits a few days before he goes. Lazarus dies, and all of Jesus' family and friends are wondering, Jesus, why did you wait? And Jesus' answer is typically, it's not time yet. The time has not yet come. When Jesus talked about his death, when that event would take place, many times he would say, my time has not yet come. The timing isn't right yet. When Jesus described his return, many times he would say, don't worry about the timing. The timing will happen when the timing is right. You just need to be ready for it because it's coming. When people attempt to seize him and kill him, there are times that he slips out of the crowd, and the only description, the only reason we're given as to why that took place is because his time had not yet come. Jesus deeply cared about timing. As we enter into, this is Palm Sunday. Palm Sunday was a significant week of waiting. That Jesus, Lord of space and time, could have, in his power, fast-forwarded through that week. I can imagine that week was awful for Jesus, knowing what was about to take place, knowing that he was about to be arrested, knowing that he was about to be betrayed, knowing that he was about to be killed by people of his creation, mocked and spit on in the worst way possible. I can imagine that Jesus was just like, let's just get that over with. Let's just hit the fast forward button on here, snap to when the resurrection happens. But he doesn't. He doesn't because he understood that timing mattered, that the will of the Father mattered. And the will of the Father involved timing. It involved, for Jesus, waiting. The same is true for us. But our waiting matters. It has a purpose. It has a point. And our waiting, the good news is, our waiting has an expiration date. Let me read one more passage to you, and then we're going to wrap up. But it's in Revelation. I love this verse. 7:16 says, they shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, and the sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat. Now, this cry for many in the world is a literal answer to prayer. that there are some in the world who are literally hungry, who wish they were not, who are waiting to be fed. There are some who are thirsty, who are waiting to receive water. There are some that are hot, who are waiting for that day to not be. This is a literal answer to their waiting. This is also a figurative answer to many of our waitings, that there is an end in sight. And it's for this reason. 17 says, "For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of living water, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes." Every single tear, every emotion, every feeling, every amount of time spent desperately waiting will be removed. That's a beautiful promise. So this week, as we move towards Easter, let's reflect on that promise, that our waiting, if you're a follower of Christ in here, your waiting has an expiration date on it already. And it was the moment that Jesus sprang from that tomb. But our waiting matters. God is in it. He desires us to draw close to him. He desires to strengthen our faith, the revealing that he is the prize. Let's pray. Lord, there are hundreds of significant waiting situations happening in this room, and you know every single one of them. There is not an emotion felt in this room, God, that you are not aware of. In the same way that you knew Jairus' anxiety, his fears, you know ours. You know the things that we so wish would desperately happen quickly. You know the things that we so desperately wish wouldn't happen. And yet, we're still in this period of waiting. So Lord, my prayer for those here, myself, God, is that you would strengthen us. Help us see the truth. The truth that you desire for us to need you. The truth that you desire us to draw close to you. And the truth that you desire us to see you as the prize. Father, so mold our hearts with those truths in mind. Fill us with hope. The greatest answer to waiting is hope. And you've given us a great source of hope, Father. It's coming this week. The death, burial, and resurrection of you, Father, is the source of our hope, and it makes the waiting worth it. Father, help us to remember that. In Jesus' name.